Hello, I'm Alan Saunders, and this week on The Philosopher's Zone, something a little different. I'm delighted to have as my guest Alexander McCall Smith, author of the number one Ladies Detective Agency, a series of crime novels set in Botswana and telling the stories of the private detective Precious Ramotswe, now a TV series on cable TV here. But he's also the author of another crime series set in his hometown of Edinburgh, the Sunday Philosophy Club. And that's mostly what we're going to be talking about today. Alexander McCall Smith, welcome to Australia and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed, Alan.
Now, your central character in this series is Isabel Dalhousie. Tell us about her.
Well, she's a professional philosopher. She runs a journal on applied ethics. And so that gives the opportunity for her to deal with all sorts of issues. She's something of a sleuth in that she gets involved in people's issues and in various inquiries into various matters. I wouldn't have thought they would be crime novels in the true sense. Sometimes she deals with bad behaviour, but most of the time she's dealing with various mysteries in people's lives or difficulties in people's lives. And, of course, she approaches all these as one who has a training in philosophy. And she also has a constant debate with herself about moral obligation and the duties that she has to others. So her life is quite philosophically rich, in a sense.
And you say that she's a professional philosopher. She's pretty well qualified in the subject, isn't she? She went to Cambridge.
She comes from Edinburgh originally. She went to Cambridge, did a degree there, and then she did some graduate work in the United States. And so she's quite well qualified to be a philosopher. Then she came back to Edinburgh and she didn't really start a proper career as an academic philosopher. She'd been left a bit of money by a relative, and so there was no immediate need to get another job. So she's able to indulge her interest in philosophy, I suppose, in the same way that philosophers in the past often had some sort of financial backing which enabled them to be philosophers, as opposed to have to do other sorts of work.
And while we're talking about qualifications, you, for a long time, were Professor of Medical Law at the University of Edinburgh and a respected expert on medical law and bioethics. You've written or co-edited books on law and medical ethics, family rights, consent to research in dementia, the jurisprudence of aid and justice, and the prosecution of old crimes. So clearly you're not a million miles away from philosophy yourself, are you?
No, in my professional career, although I was a professor of law, the intersection of law and philosophy, obviously, is very close. I tended to look at a lot of these issues of medical law and indeed of medical and scientific practice in general from a philosophical point of view, paying attention to some of the ethical issues to which they give rise.
As a character, it seems to me that Isabel does think a lot like a philosopher. She's always questioning her own thoughts, feelings, and behaviour, but she tends to do so in terms of rather abstract concepts, doesn't she? That's what philosophers often do.
Yes, I think this is the interesting thing about her, and perhaps the contrast between Isabel and one of my other characters, Mara Motswe, of the number one Ladies Detective Agency series, in that Mara Motswe looks at matters on the basis of her experience and the wisdom that has come with that, whereas Isabel Dalhousie looks at a lot of matters in terms of notions of obligation, or I suppose she looks to what the theoretical philosophical position is and then tries to sort things out on that basis. So she's much more theoretical.
And what is the Sunday Philosophy Club?
Well, the Sunday Philosophy Club is a club that Isabel, in volume one of that series, decides to get started, that she'll get people around the house and have a discussion of philosophical matters each Sunday. But she never really gets organised, and so it never meets. So there's never a meeting of the Sunday Philosophy Club. And in the subsequent novels, we haven't really heard about the Sunday Philosophy Club. And now my publishers have decided just to call the thing the Isabel Dalhousie series, and we've forgotten about the Sunday Philosophy Club. So it's a club that never meets, which of course is probably quite a nice sort of club to belong to. A member of a club that never meets, that's fine.
And of course, having a philosophy club like that, or having what would have been a philosophy club like that, that's quite a happening thing these days, isn't it? A lot of people are meeting together for philosophical discussions in bars and cafes and so on.
That's right, and I think that's a wonderful development. It's very interesting to see that happening. It's very significant that there's increasing interest in philosophy and in matters of applied ethics, I suppose. People are more and more interested in those. And newspapers that used to have advice columns dealing with people's queries as to what they should do now are having resident philosophers, which I think is a terrific development. And I did read that the psychoanalysts in certain cities were having a bit of a thin time of it because philosophers had put up their brass plates.
The stories are set, as I've said, in Edinburgh, and you're very good at evoking an Edinburgh that is quite unlike the one that we encounter in, say, the Rebus books of Ian Rankin. In fact, Grace, who's Isabel's housekeeper, believes, according to Isabel, in the rather old-fashioned concept of douce Edinburgh. I presume that means sweet or soft Edinburgh. What's behind the idea?
Well, Edinburgh is a very interesting city from that point of view. It is, of course, associated with the Jekyll and Hyde phenomenon. Edinburgh's always, I suppose, as some other cities do as well, had two faces. There's respectable Edinburgh, and then in the background there's the rather less than respectable Edinburgh. And there was a famous story of a local magistrate or politician years ago who was a respected figure by day and then a burglar by night.
This is Deacon Brodie.
Deacon Brodie, yeah. That goes to the heart of this alleged bifurcation in Edinburgh's soul. But I think one of the problems is that the portrayal of Edinburgh, and a beautiful portrayal in Ian Rankin's books, which I admire, obviously Ian is dealing with the underbelly of Edinburgh. Now, in fact, there's a very major, terribly respectable, rather prim side to Edinburgh, which exists as well. And I suppose that's the Edinburgh which I've been portraying, which actually really is quite entertaining. It's a rather brittle, rather sharp atmosphere that prevails there. That's what I explore.
You mentioned Deacon Brodie and Jekyll and Hyde, this notion of duality, which does seem to be a recurrent theme. I don't know whether it's an Edinburgh theme or a generally Scottish theme. There's also James Hogg's book, The Confessions of a Justified Sinner, to which Isabel alludes at one point. This notion of duality in the Scottish, or perhaps just the Edinburgh character, do you think it has something to do with Calvinism?
I was just about to say that, yes. Yes, I think that's quite right. I think that the Scottish Calvinist inheritance has created a very strong sense of duty or propriety in the Scottish psyche. So there's a strong notion of what one should do, a strong notion of individual conscience, which of course was what the Scottish Reformation was all about. So Scots have always had an idea of how they must think correctly and think carefully. And of course, there was also, let's not forget, the Enlightenment, which suggested that we should focus on the reasonable and on the whole process and role of reason. And so there's that side. And then the other side is, of course, the side that all of us have of wanting to have fun, wanting to let one's hair down, and so on. Now, that is a duality. It would be in that historical background that we would find the roots of that duality. It must be the case.
Now, as you say, Edinburgh was one of the homes of the Scottish Enlightenment, that great movement of ideas in the 18th century. Isabel clearly knows all about this. At one stage, she talks about that proto-Darwinian philosopher, the wonderfully named, I think, Lord Monboddo. But is this heritage important for the citizens of Edinburgh today?
Well, it's obviously not terribly important for the man or woman in the street who doesn't go about talking about Hume and his writings. But I think that it is important for the intellectual life of Edinburgh, in that people in Edinburgh who are concerned with matters of the mind are aware of their heritage. And if you ask such people whether it was significant to them that they lived in the city of Hume, they would probably with pride say, yes, it is a factor. So there is a sense of an association with a particular intellectual spirit, and it's a fairly intellectually active city.
And about 250 years too late, Edinburgh did finally acquire a public statue of Hume, didn't it?
Yes.
Looking startlingly naked.
Yes, that's right. I think it's a good statue, actually. I think Isabel had a bit of criticism about what Hume was wearing. Hume in a toga wasn't really what she had in mind. But I think it's a good public statue. I rather like it. One can forget just how influential, during that brief period, Edinburgh and Scotland were. Now, I think the problem is that it was quite a brief period, and although there was that stage when Edinburgh was stellar in philosophical terms, then during the 19th century, I think that Edinburgh became a bit of a backwater in a sense. It was romanticised. All of Scotland was romanticised by the Victorians, and I think that that intellectual rigour was still there, but somehow it lost its position. I think that that has changed to an extent. Edinburgh, I think, is still punching above its weight intellectually, and in recent years there's been tremendous amount of useful thinking emanating from Edinburgh. The fact that Scotland got a parliament back was quite important. That gave a bit of a fillip to the intellectual life of the city.
Now, Isabel is, as you say, the editor of a journal called The Review of Applied Ethics. This is a question to which we might return, but do you think that crime writing, or, as you've said in the case of Isabel, you know, problem writing, writing about dealing with people's problems, I think you clearly do think that's an exercise in applied ethics, don't you?
I think it is. I think there are fundamental philosophical issues at the heart of crime fiction. W.H. Auden made a comment about this when he remarked on how important it was in the crime novel that the moral balance be restored.
I'm coming to him later.
Right, yes, we must get on to Auden.
Yes.
But others have said a similar thing as well. And I think that you would find in many crime novels that there are issues of philosophical significance being talked about. I mean, obviously, when somebody is doing a bit of detecting and dealing with evidence, we've got issues of logic coming up. We've got the whole issue of how one puts two and two together and one hopes makes four. That all of that has obviously some sort of philosophical significance. These books are also about how people treat one another and how we should treat one another. So crime fiction really is a wonderful vehicle for all sorts of investigations, including psychological investigations. And in these Isabel Dalhousie books, one of the main things that she thinks about, one of the main issues, is the question of the extent of our moral obligation to others. She talks about this notion of moral proximity and how far should we engage in the problems of others. When are we brought into a relationship which gives rise to a duty to act? That sort of thing. So these issues can come up while you're talking about a criminal issue.
On ABC Radio National, this is The Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Alexander McCall-Smith about his series of novels, The Sunday Philosophy Club. Well, let's have a closer look, Alexander, at Isabel's philosophical interests. To begin with, she doesn't seem to like the great German philosopher of the 18th century, Immanuel Kant, does she?
Well, I suspect, like many philosophers, she has a bit of a love-hate relationship with Kant, in that I think that obviously there are such profound and important things in Kant that one cannot ignore him. I think she finds it a little bit heavy, in a sense. I think that's probably the way she feels about that. On the other hand, she doesn't like the rather sort of light and insubstantial concerns, she would say, of linguistic philosophy of the second half of the 20th century. So she's not terribly keen on that. So I suppose she's quite eclectic. She would take bits and pieces from everywhere.
And probably rather unusually for philosophers in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, she certainly believes in evil, doesn't she?
Yes, yes. As you say, that's something which I suppose many philosophers in the Anglo-Saxon tradition have stopped talking about. But it is still there, and I suppose she would probably still believe in good and talk about the role of good as well. I think at some point, if I remember correctly, I think she talks about Iris Murdoch and Iris Murdoch's interest in the concept of good.
This is an interesting aspect of her character. You're very good, I think, as a writer at creating nice people like Isabel and Precious who are still interesting, which is quite a difficult task for a writer, I think. And part of what makes Isabel a nice person is something that you've already alluded to, the fact that she gets drawn into other people's lives because she thinks that they have a moral claim on her.
Yes, that is something which I find very interesting, and I suspect that most of us think about that problem from time to time. We think about it if we're walking along the street and let's say we see a beggar or somebody asks us for something. Now, I think that's a moment of awkwardness for many of us. I've recently been in India, and of course many visitors to India comment on the fact that you actually do get immediate and urgent requests made of your charity at every point. And what do you do if you're in a car in a big city and you stop and somebody comes up to the window and scratches with their fingernails at the window? How more of a direct appeal can be made to you? What do you do? Do you always give money? Do you, in which case there comes no end to it? Or do you just say, well, I'll make a formal contribution to a charity that gives help on an organised basis or whatever? I think it's a real problem for people.
I do give regular formal contributions to a charity because I thought, well, then I won't have to feel bad about walking past beggars in the street. But it doesn't work.
It doesn't
really.
Well, that's right, because, you see, it shows the difference between the formal recognition of the moral obligation and then the immediate human recognition. And I agree with you, it really is extremely difficult. So Isabel looks at that.
One of Isabel's favourite poets is somebody whose name's already come up here, W.H. Auden. And he, as you mentioned, wrote an article called The Guilty Vicarage, Notes on the Detective Story by an Addict. And here he writes, the fantasy then which the detective story addict indulges in is the fantasy of being restored to the Garden of Eden, to a state of innocence, where he may know love as love and not as the law. The driving force behind this daydream is the feeling of guilt, the cause of which is unknown to the dreamer. The fantasy of escape is the same whether one explains the guilt in Christian, Freudian or any other terms. There's a sense of order, if not of Eden, being restored at the end of your book. So do you agree with Auden?
Yes, I agree with Auden to an extent. I don't think that I'm as troubled as Auden was by guilt. I had a very interesting conversation with Auden's executor, Edward Mendelssohn, about this, who told me about the neurotic basis of guilt in much of Auden's work. But I mean, I'm not too worried about that aspect of it. But I certainly agree with Auden about this Eden to which he sees us gravitating, so to speak. Yes, we need a concept of Eden. We need to believe, I think, in justice. We need to run our lives as if justice existed. Now, it's rather like the position with determinism and free will, that even if you accept the intellectual argument in favour of determinism or the strength of the determinist position, you actually can't run your life as if determinism really were true. And I think that's the same with the notion of justice or Eden. If we abandon a belief that justice will eventually be done, we make this world much more difficult for ourselves.
Something else that Auden says is the detective story writer is wise to choose a society with an elaborate ritual and to describe this in detail. A ritual is a sign of harmony between the aesthetic and the ethical, in which body and mind, individual will and general laws are not in conflict. The murderer uses his knowledge of the ritual to commit the crime, and he assumes it's going to be a murderer. The murderer uses his knowledge of the ritual to commit the crime and can be caught only by someone who acquires an equal or superior familiarity with it. I don't know whether this is true of the Isabel Dalhousie novels, but it's certainly true of your Botswanan stories, isn't it?
Yes. I certainly understand the attachment that Auden had both theoretically and indeed in his own life to ritual. Of course, we're talking about a poet here who insisted that the martinis were served at 6 o'clock precisely, and you couldn't be late for martinis. And he was notoriously prickly about keeping appointments. People should keep their appointments to the minute. And I think that was all tied up with a fairly ritualistic personality in a way. But I understand the role of ritual and the importance of ritual. And I'd even go further than that and say not only does a knowledge of ritual therefore help the person who's trying to work out what has gone wrong in a particular group or society, but that this ritual is a terribly important binding cement in society, that if we abandon formality and rituals, we're actually weakening the relationships that exist between people that bind them. This is another thing which I really like investigating in my novels. What is it that makes an intimate society, that makes a society in which moral concern for others will be possible? Part of that, I think, manners and ritual. We tried to get rid of manners. We tried to abolish manners in the 60s. Manners were very, very old-fashioned and uncool. And, of course, we didn't realise that manners are the building blocks of proper moral relationships between people.
In fact, you've said, just getting back to the number one latest detective agency, you've said that people in sub-Saharan African cultures have a strong sense of human values and they're frequently very empathetic. As a result, one finds a balance of humour and good nature in such societies.
Yes, I think I'd largely stick to that. Obviously, the sub-Saharan African societies have changed dramatically over the last few decades, and that there's been, I suppose, conflict between modernity and the older values, and modernity tends to win. But I do think that there are a set of values which are present in many of those societies, which I think are, broadly speaking, communitarian values. And those communitarian values, I think, have a very strong empathetic component to them. So I would say that where you can get back to the, or locate or identify the traditional African values insofar as they survive in those societies, they are rather good ones.
And is that even remotely true of Isabel Dalhousie's Edinburgh?
I think it is, to an extent, yes. I think that there is still in Edinburgh and in Scotland in general an echo of the particular values which were instilled in Scottish people during the 18th, 19th century, and I suppose the earlier part of the 20th century, when the influence of Scottish Presbyterianism was still evident, and where people actually had a great deal of education in morality. I think we're living on that moral capital and probably have been living on it for some time. I think that we've made great moral progress in the second half of the 20th century in many respects, and particularly in relation to human rights. I think that's the great moral leap forward which occurred in the second half of the 20th century. But I think that we are losing sight of some of the values of concern for others and self-respect and respect for others, which actually were inculcated in a fairly intensive moral education program that was standard for Scots until quite recently. And you see it if you speak to the older generation in Scotland. You get people who still have that rather stern individual responsibility approach to things. It's still there.
Well, details of Alexander McCall Smith's novels on our website, which is also the place to go if you wish to engage in conversation with us and with your fellow listeners about this or any other edition of the show. The address is abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. And I've been talking to Alexander McCall Smith. Alexander, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Alan.
The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Kyla Slavin with technical production by Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders. Back next week.